Waste. There's no escaping it.
The country buries 80% of its rubbish.
The plastic is absolutely everywhere. No place is without it.
I don't think that people actually realize on a day-to-day basis what the impact actually is.
And waste production rates are rising. Research from the World Bank estimates that we're responsible for over 2 billion tons of rubbish every year. With rapid population growth and urbanization, the world's annual garbage generation is expected to increase by 70% to 3.4 billion tons in 2050.
All I see is this rubbish getting more and more and more every single day.
My name's Alexandra Spring. I'm a journalist and I write about sustainability and the impact humans are having on the planet. In this series for the BBC World Service, I'm exploring how our relationship with rubbish has evolved over time.
Waste is very revealing about what we do, what we think and who we are. It would be quite a horrific thing to see everything that you had ever consumed and thrown away.
And in this first episode, before I look back at our wasteful past, I'm examining the reality of today's trash challenge.
I never could have even imagined how much we produce. It's just shocking.
This is the history of wastefulness on the BBC World Service. I'm standing outside my house in Sydney, where every week I put my rubbish in a bin, it gets collected, and soon it's gone. But how did it get to the point today where it's so easy to be so wasteful in developed countries like here in Australia? Here's Professor Gay Hawkins from Western Sydney University, who researches how history has shaped our wasteful ways.
Well, it starts really with the introduction of the sewerage system, because there's been some great histories written of the introduction of sanitation in the growth of 19th century cities. And that was an amazing public health achievement. But people were much more used to, before the rise of sanitation, to seeing waste, detritus, human and animal filth in their everyday encounters in cities. Now, that might have been pretty bad for their public health, but it was pretty good for understanding that, you know, waste was close to you, it was visible, you had to avoid it and move through it. What a sewerage system or sanitation system does is introduce an infrastructure of rapid disappearance where you really don't know what happens to it. So flushing is the beginning of that culture of it just disappears. We've had increasing distance from our waste over the 20th century. And that's a good thing. It's why you've had the growth of mass cities. But it means that we don't understand what happens to our waste when we're finished with it, where it goes, how it accumulates, the kind of environmental and pollution effects it generates, because that all happens in a hidden reality that is often at the edge of cities, these shadow places that are filthy, horrifying, toxic, and most ordinary people don't encounter them.
I don't fully understand the ins and outs of where my waste goes when it gets picked up from outside my house. But there's a place that has become the focal point for today's trash challenge, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's an area of the ocean that I've read a lot about and that I want to experience for myself, which is why I'm on a boat off the coast of California with George Leonard. He's chief scientist at Ocean Conservancy, which have been working to protect the seas for over 30 years.
The garbage patch essentially is a term that's been created to refer to this area of the ocean where there's a greater concentration of plastics than there are in other parts of the ocean. The current estimate is it's about sort of twice the size of Texas. You know, it's 1,000 miles or more across.
And how much plastic are we talking about here?
We think that every year there's about 8 million metric tons of plastic. And mostly the conversation about debris and garbage in the ocean is really a plastics conversation. But we think that there's about 8 million metric tons of plastic that flows into the ocean all around the world, from all the countries that have coastal access.
To understand more about where all this waste is coming from, I'm connecting with Dr. Daniel Hornweg, Associate Professor in Energy Systems at the University of Ontario in Canada.
High-income countries are the ones that generate the lion's share of the waste. So high-income is about 16% of the world's population. But we in the high-income countries generate about 34% of the world's garbage, where collection and proper disposal is the worst would be in low-income countries. and where we see the biggest challenges on the horizon are probably sub-Saharan Africa, where they're likely going to have a threefold increase in total waste generation by 2050, so less than 35 years.
And how are different continents and countries dealing with that waste?
Europe tends to be more focused on diversion composting. Part of that's less land area, whereas in the US and Canada, we tend to generate more waste. You have things, so for example, Japan has roughly the same per capita wealth as say we do here in Canada, but they generate almost half as much waste as we do in Canada, simply because there's a different cultural development around the production of waste. So, you know, for example, bigger houses, more garbage, these sorts of things. But I don't think anybody really out there in the high income well or in any country is really a saint when it comes to solid waste. Some are doing parts of it better than others, but overall, there really is a growing awareness that we kind of are, I mean, hyperbole perhaps, but we really are burying ourselves in garbage.
So we know this waste is coming from pretty much everywhere, George, but I'll be honest, I can't really see that much plastic.
So the really important thing for people to recognize about plastics in the ocean is that they never really break down. They never biodegrade. They never go away. They get broken into smaller and smaller in bits. And at some point, you can't see the plastic in the ocean with your eyes, but it's still very much there. And it's because the plastic that's out there is made up of these teeny-weeny little flecks. It's more like a soup. It's more like a plastic soup than it's a floating island of trash. The way that happens is by two things. One is the sunlight, like the sun that we have over our shoulders here, and the other are the waves. And waves create a force that when it smashes on top of bits and plastics that have become brittle because of sun, then they break into smaller and smaller pieces.
So what? The plastic is everywhere.
We know that it's floating at the surface, and we know that we can find plastics at the bottom. And we also know that a lot of these little teeny flecks of plastic are somewhere in the water column between the surface and the bottom. We also know that plastics can be found from the equator to both poles, the North Pole and the South Pole. And interestingly, we have found a lot of microplastics and microfibers, these very, very small pieces in sea ice, in Arctic sea ice.
Hearing George chat about today's trash challenge in the ocean really does highlight a cultural shift in our attitude to waste over the past few decades, as Gay Hawkins explains.
It is a massive cultural change, and all of us would have parents or perhaps grandparents that have got a garage full of stuff. I can go to my mother's place, for example, and say, oh, you should get rid of that. She says, no, that might come in handy someday. She has a drawer full of paper bags that she's carefully sort of smoothed out and folded, hundreds of glass jars. So she just comes from a culture where making do was essential growing up in the Depression, where keeping things that still had functional value, even though their immediate use might have been finished, in order for them to be reused, was just part of her sort of cultural reality. So she finds it very hard to throw things away because she just has a psychology and a disposition which says, this is useful. It couldn't possibly be wasted. Whereas my generation, and especially my children's generation, just have moved into the period where far more of the stuff that we purchased was designed to be disposable. So if you think about the rise of the fast food industry, eating in the street, eating moving around, that depended on the rise of a packaged economy, which just generates mountains and mountains of waste. But my generation thinks it's fine to go out and eat a meal where you just get up and walk away from the table and there's half a bin full of polystyrene trays, plastic knives and forks, straws, cups. Yeah, so that's a dramatic change. Really, it happens after the First World War, the 1950s, and it happens through the real escalation of mass consumption, the growth of the fast food industry, and also a change in the materials used in packaging. That's when you get the real introduction of plastic into packaging, into many aspects of everyday life, and that is not
a sustainable material. It does not break down, and it contributed to a massive increase in hard waste in domestic bins and in local council and state government infrastructures. It just generated a massive problem.
And today, what's the result of that cultural shift towards waste?
We have an ethics of waste now, which is about not caring. For many people, it is about not noticing, not feeling responsible, just continually wasting and discarding because you need to in this incredibly materially dense life that we lead and because of the levels of consumption that we all engage in. I mean, I am sitting here now in a studio with a disposable coffee cup that I bought just before the interview, so that's got to be got rid of. But, you know, and that's just a small amount of waste that I've generated in 10 minutes. If you think about how much you're generating throughout the day, if you buy a takeaway lunch, if you decide to pop into a shop on the way home and they've got a sale on clothes that you might buy on impulse and then wear once and get rid of. We just live in an incredibly high waste culture, and a culture in which wasting is essential to modes of being and to the function of the economy.
The idea that our current waste problem could be the result of a new obsession with replacement and convenience fascinates me, as does the connection between rubbish and the economy. And this is something Daniel Hornwig knows all about.
There's a phenomenon that happens here in Canada and the States. The week after Christmas, residential waste volumes more than double. So they have to hire extra trucks because they just generate so much more trash. And you see the same thing during Ramadan. We just have this cultural predilection that when we're happy and when we're celebrating, we generate more waste. The fastest way you can tell if an economy is headed toward a recession right now is that you get a drop in waste quantities. The GDP of a country, the health of the GDP is measured by how much waste it's producing. So that's the part of the system that we really have to address. But that's really difficult. Our economies are designed still to take as much stuff, whether it's oil or trees or minerals, send it through the economy and generate waste. And that method or that process is what generates a lot of our wealth still. And we all like wealth.
George, what about the environmental price we're paying for our wasteful ways? Are we looking at a toxic ocean here?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that this problem of garbage and trash and particularly plastic in the ocean is not just a visual problem. It's not just that it's unsightly. It turns out that we're basically poisoning the ocean. Plastics have sort of two problems with them. The first is that many plastics are made with chemicals that we know are problematic from kind of animal or human health. But then the other thing they do is they can concentrate toxins which are no longer in use but are still out in the ocean and out in the environment. They basically act as sponges and they suck them up and they stick to the surface of the plastic. And so individual little teeny bits of plastic kind of carry around this this little delivery of a variety of really toxic chemicals. And the problem is that as the pieces get smaller and smaller, lots of small animals in the ocean in particular can and do ingest them. So what happens is that plastic isn't just floating in the ocean water, it's actually finding its way into the food web. We now know that something like 800 different species of marine life are impacted by plastic, and this is everything from the smallest phytoplankton and zooplankton. These are the teeny little animals and the teeny little plants that form the base of the food web, all the way up to the largest animal that's ever lived on the face of the planet, the blue whale. That has two problems. The first is that we now know that it impacts the health and well-being of the marine life itself. But the other problem is that as humans, scientists are now increasingly worried that those chemicals are going to find their way to humans themselves. The only logical conclusion here is that we need to reduce the amount of plastics that are getting into our systems and they're getting into the marine environment.
This is The History of Wastefulness on the BBC World Service. And I'm Alexandra Spring, examining how our relationship with rubbish has evolved over time. In this episode, I'm examining the reality of today's trash challenge, which is something that Kadir van Lohuizen has captured with his camera.
I'm a photojournalist from the Netherlands, and I've been documenting waste for the last 30 years.
Kadir was working on a remote Pacific island when he had the idea for Wasteland, a project where he could visually investigate how waste is managed across the globe.
There was always plastic on the beaches. Speaking to the people there, they all said this plastic is not from here, it's from elsewhere, we don't know from where. Myself, I didn't really knew anymore what was happening to my own garbage. So, you know, I mean, in Amsterdam, we have a garbage truck, comes twice a week, you put it on the curb, it's being collected, and then it's gone, and it looks clean. So I decided to see how their waste is managed, or often mismanaged. In the end, I went to six major cities in the world, which were Jakarta, Tokyo, Lagos, Sao Paulo, New York, and Amsterdam.
I'm interested, you've been to the, you know, six mega cities. What's the worst thing that you saw, the thing that shocked you the most?
I never could have even imagined how much we produce. It's just shocking. If you see, you know, I mean, if you see all these trucks or whatever arriving at one place from 1 hour, from one city, it's just shocking to realize. And again, it's shocking to realize what we all throw away, right? I mean, if we think about ourselves, we all know that we've thrown stuff away which we shouldn't have thrown away, that we've thrown food away which was actually still okay to consume. So, you know, I mean, we all guilty to some extent.
Is there a standout image for you? Which is the one that sticks in your head?
Yeah, there's a few, but maybe one of them is in Lagos. Is an image where you see a garbage truck arriving. The scene was just incredible because you have these garbage trucks arriving and they are literally almost being attacked by people, like if they were carrying large amounts of cash. When it opens, the garbage truck opens, everybody kind of dives in, and everyone is actually looking for their specific item. So one is in charge of the plastics, and the one is in charge of the textiles. And so it's actually very organized, where it looks like this apocalyptic scene.
Kadir witnessed organized but unregulated scavengers working at dumps in Nigeria, which is very different to what he experienced in Brazil.
Sao Paulo is one of the few cities in the world where the profession scavenger is a legal profession. So they are organized. They're organized in unions. They have cooperatives. So it's much better organized than any of the other cities I've been. So it's established what a kilo of scrap metal sells for, or plastic, or paper, or etc. So they're being protected. They're protected by a union as well. So the prices are kind of realistic and don't get dumped like often elsewhere.
There's an old saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure, the etymology of which has been lost to time. But for people like Gilberto and thousands of his colleagues across Brazil and further afield, rubbish is more than just treasure. It's his life.
My name is Gilberto, and I'm a collector of recyclable material. I'm part of the national movement of waste pickers. I've been a picker since 1988, since I was a boy. In the beginning, I was hunting aluminium food packaging. Then we got together to sell it and started picking scrap metal and follow the path of garbage collecting. For many years, people always look at us as homeless people, those unable to do other jobs. So we became an association, a cooperative, and it gained another meaning. People began to approach us on the street and say, "Do you know that you are serving the city? Do you know that what you collect helps to preserve the environment?" People started to see the work, see the relevance of the work of the waste picker, of recycling. They see us as environmental agents. Although this is a difficult mission because we live in a consumer society, the citizen thinks that the relationship of a person with the garbage is to get rid of it by placing it in front of his door so the city will take it. He does not want to know where it goes, he just wants to solve this immediate problem. We need to start using things for a longer period. give them a longer lifespan, reduce consumption, consume only what is needed, reuse as much as possible, recycle as much as possible. This is the right path.
Gilberto and many other informal recyclers in Brazil left a lasting impression on Kadir.
The scavengers I saw in Lagos and Jakarta and other places, they became kind of the heroes of the story, you know. Often they are being seen as that they are probably homeless, that they are drug addicts, that they have issues, and, you know, and I'm not saying that it doesn't exist. But most of the people I met are families who are trying to make a living and get their kids to school so that they don't have to work as a scavenger. So, you know, I mean, I think that we need to understand that as well. they're doing more to save us than most of us.
But it's not just in Lagos and Sao Paulo where people are getting their hands dirty when it comes to dealing with today's trash challenge. I've come to Italy because I want to understand more about how ancient civilizations dealt with waste and what we can learn from the past as we look to the future. But before I go back in time, I'm going to collect some litter.
Mama, I want to clean my city. I give for my son and all people that meet me a good example.
That's Ilaria, who leads a group of pickers in Rome. She gets people together every weekend and they take to the streets to pick up waste left behind by other people. And it's fair to say there's a lot of rubbish here in the city. I've been speaking to some tourists to find out what they think of waste here in the Italian capital.
Before we came to Rome, they said you have to look for the... never look at the ground, they say. So people in Belgium, they knew it. Everywhere we go, every corner of the street, we see the rubbish, we see... yeah, yeah. Especially in the evening when the tourists are gone, it's, yeah, we see it.
I think it's from the tourists.
We were very lucky, we went on a food tour today, and one of the biggest things that they seem to use a lot of plastics and a lot of paper. So I don't know, are they as environmentally aware or not? I don't know. But I do think they were talking about the sewers weren't in a great state as well, so, and there's a lot of people living in Rome.
I have noticed the garbage in Rome. It's on the streets, and it's very dirty.
It's almost one of the first things you notice when you come into the city.
Really?
Well, yeah, on the bus from the airport.
We're from New Zealand, so there's no litter or rubbish on the ground.
Very, very noticeable.
It's dirty.
But what factors impact on how much people litter? Here's Gay Hawkins.
Littering is very much about the atmosphere of various places. So it's about various kinds of social cues. So if you go to a place where there's lots of litter already in evidence, people are more likely to litter because they just think, well, nobody cares, everyone else has done it, I won't make any difference. So they might be conscientious non-litterers in certain situations, but in other situations that are filthy, littering is going to increase. In other countries such as Japan, where I've done some research, and that's the cleanest country in the world where there's absolutely no littering, well, very minor forms of littering, you can see there that in schools, children are trained to clean up the school at the end of the day. So they tidy up their classroom, they tidy up the playground, and they are just trained in a form of civic responsibility. So they're trained to see that public space or the schoolyard or the street or their front garden or their community is a space that everyone's responsible for. So there's what I would call a very strong sense of civic responsibility in Japan and communal consideration. And, you know, it's a really interesting example of the ways in which a kind of civic atmosphere prevents littering.
You've spoken to me a lot about the ethics of waste and what factors impact on how wasteful we are as humans. But in your opinion, who really is to blame for today's trash challenge?
The source of the problem is that we live in a high-waste culture that's driven by the constant production of single-use goods at the heart of so many industries. They couldn't function without them, but those industries take very minor responsibility for the massive burden of waste and pollution that they are generating. That's where the problem lies. It is not a consumer problem.
I will always support preventing waste, both personally and through my work as a sustainability journalist. And I agree with Daniel Hornwig that we should all be playing our role to prevent today's trash challenge, no matter how insignificant our actions may seem.
We all eat food, we all produce waste, and we all produce solid waste. And those are the things that if we start as individuals to address those, they get magnified very quickly on a citywide scale and then a countrywide scale and then globally. So I would say start with your solid waste. Recycle more, compost more, and as much as possible, buy less stuff.
Next time on The History of Wastefulness. After examining the reality of today's trash challenge, I'll be investigating our wasteful past.
When you talk about the Mayas, households are discreet. You can't find the beams of the household, but you can usually find where their garbage pit is. You can recover their garbage and see what they were using, what they were discarding.
Traveling to ancient rubbish dumps to explore how our relationship with rubbish has evolved over time.
As we climb Monte Testaccio, you can hear the sound under our feet of the pottery over a century of broken amphora. As I throw a piece of amphora like this to the ground, and you think, well, that's ancient, that's precious. I chuckle because for archaeologists today, this is just waste.
The History of Wastefulness is an Audio Always production for the BBC World Service.